This is Brian Trumbore with the Week in Review, October 13th through 17th, titled Wall Street Stopping the Bleeding. At times like these, we're looking for heroes, and at least for this week, the man who stepped forward to attempt to lead the world out of this financial debacle is British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Funny was him, seeing as Gordon was dead and buried by those in his own Labour Party, as well as your editor, just a few weeks ago. But it was Brown who, in the words of the London Times' Philip Webster, sought to don the mantle of Churchill and Roosevelt as he called for world leaders to gather for a new Bretton Woods, the conference held in 1944 to draw up a post-war financial order. First Britain, then Europe, now the world, a conservative frontbencher said in Britain, reflecting on Mr. Brown's newfound confidence as he tackled the financial crisis, making a plethora of speeches, press conference appearances, and trips on the international stage. The Financial Times editorialized, Gordon Brown came to save capitalism, not to bury it. Paying $60 billion to Part D nationalize some of the commanding heights of the economy may not be many people's idea of what free marketing governments do, but the Prime Minister has taken bold steps to save the financial system and with it the real economy. The model he set out for rescuing banks is a good one, is now being imitated across Europe and in the U.S. Mr. Brown's measures to recapitalize banks, to guarantee interbank lending, and to extend liquidity provisions are systematic and comprehensive. The scale of the response is indicative of the depth of this financial crisis, arguably the worst of the past century. That was the Financial Times. Well, Europe followed, led by French President Nicolas Sarkozy, as France, Germany, Spain, the Netherlands, and Austria committed $1.8 trillion to guarantee bank loans and take stakes in lenders. Sarkozy said the greatest risk is in inertia. And then the United States stepped in as the Treasury, Federal Reserve, and FDIC acted in various ways, including a pledge to take $250 billion of the $700 billion rescue plan and inject it directly into those banks most needing a capital boost, including the first $125 billion for Citigroup, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Bank of New York, Mellon, and State Street, while the government is guaranteeing interbank lending for 3 years, any new debt offered by those banks taking federal money, and a guarantee from the FDIC that it will insure 100% of non-interest-bearing accounts, which most impacts small businesses who hold such funds for mundane things like meeting payrolls. In return, the feds are going to earn a 5% dividend on preferred shares, though the hope is the banks will then buy out the government's stakes as the credit markets open up and the ability to raise private capital returns. Just understand that while the situation is fluid, this week's actions were truly momentous, not just for the U.S., but around the world. And to those all hot and bothered about the end of capitalism and free markets, seriously, don't lose sleep over it. I sure as hell am not when it comes to the banks. As for other sectors of the economy and government interference, well, that's another story. For now, to paraphrase Linus as he's bucking up Charlie Brown's disastrous Christmas tree, our system isn't all bad. Nothing that a little regulation and responsibility won't cure. Here's an editorial from the Wall Street Journal. The government's rescue plan moved into a new phase Monday night with the announcement that Treasury is injecting $125 billion into the country's nine largest banks. This amount, as much as $25 billion each for the biggest, seems to have stopped the financial panic for now by easing fears of insolvency. Another $125 billion is on the table for other banks that need capital in the same terms offered to the big boys. The good news here is that Treasury Secretary Paulson has at last moved from promises to action, and credit markets have responded positively. But this is also a very dangerous moment. The government has taken ownership stakes in the largest banks in the land. This extraordinary intervention is perilous, not least to the banks themselves, unless it is limited in scope and time. Mr. Paulson called the capital injection distasteful but unavoidable, and we can't disagree. The trick is to ensure that neither he nor his successors develop a taste for politically distressed credit. The editorial in the Journal continues, for those of us who believe in free markets, these interventions are unpleasant. These drastic steps might have been avoided had Treasury and the FDIC acted sooner, yet now they are necessary given the panic that threatens the larger economy. The goal should be to rebuild the financial system so Americans can once again trust their banks enough that government can recede to its normal supervisory role. We are under no illusions that government will cede its new powers easily, but if it doesn't, the economic damage will be far greater than anything we've seen so far. Now, not all our confident government officials have stumbled on this solution. Rather, some, as best represented by columnist Ben Stein in the New York Times, remain very angry. Stein writes, "A few days ago, I spoke to a large gathering of investors in the San Diego suburb of La Jolla and was startled by the audience's furious anger at the powers that be. The Wall Street, Treasury, Federal Reserve access is hated, loathed, and feared by these people. In fact, they're among the angriest upper and middle class people I've ever seen, and the most frightened and worried. And why not? With the experiment of allowing a major investment bank, Lehman Brothers, to simply vanish, leaving huge holes in the portfolios of many other financial entities, Henry M. Paulson Jr., the Treasury Secretary, threw the financial system into chaos." Stein continues, "When confidence is gone, it's really gone. We see the results all around us in what seems to be a gathering slowdown. For those of us surveying the financial statements we can get online at any moment to destroy our sleep, the recession is already here. And it looks a lot like a depression if we add in the losses on our real estate. People planning for retirement were told they could expect that their savings in broad indices of common stocks would double roughly every 10 years, but we are now below where we were in 1998. If pre-retirees needed that doubling to get to their savings goals, they are now cut off at the knees. Unless the stock market stages a miraculous recovery, and I pray it does, a whole generation of boomers will be hopelessly far from its needs for savings." Stein continues, "I wonder if Mr. Paulson, with his hundreds of millions in the bank, really understands the terror of those people in the room in La Jolla and the tens of millions like them. I wonder if Mr. Bernanke does. I wonder if, as they rolled the dice on Lehman and came up snake eyes, they thought of the fear that would spread throughout the land. What do people, decent, hard-working people, do now? The standard advice would be to buy when the market is down, and it's probably good advice, but only probably, because we have no idea how far down we'll go or how long it will take to recover. Maybe it's better to be liquid now, but then again, maybe not. Uncertainty and fear rule. Frankly, I don't know the answer. I just know that for a long time we have paid Wall Street experts unimaginable sums for preparing for our retirement. They still have our money, and we have ashes, and I wonder whose side government is on, which is a bad thought to have. And I wish I didn't have it. As the song goes, there is revolution in the air." That was Ben Stein. I would say it's important to remind everyone that the fundamentals are absolutely awful these days. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, in surprising the street with a profitable quarter, added JPM will need to set aside more money to cover loan losses as it braces for the economic slump to, quote, get a lot worse. Dimon adds, "If you're not fearful, you're crazy." Earlier, Bill Gates told an audience we were headed for a fairly significant recession, and the World Bank's Robert Zoellick warned the global crisis was hitting development markets particularly hard. The poorest and most vulnerable groups risk the most serious and in some cases permanent damage, Zoellick said. Additionally, the International Monetary Fund, in estimating that credit losses will now hit at least $1.4 trillion, and I hasten to remind you Ben Bernanke once said it would only be $50 billion, concludes, "The global financial system is on the verge of systemic meltdown." And legendary investor Julian Robertson told CNBC he expected 10 to 15 years of a poor economy. Just look at the U.S. and Britain. In the U.K., unemployment is at a 17-year high, home sales a 30-year low, and retail spending cratered 1.5% in September. In the U.S., where does one begin? Just this week, we learned retail sales for September plummeted 1.2%, industrial production collapsed 2.8%, another manufacturing barometer, the Philly Fed Index, hit a staggering minus 37.5 for October. Housing starts for September came in at a mere 817,000, the lowest figure in 17 years, and putting us on a track for a full year total not seen in six decades. Building permits, a measure of future activity, hit their worst level since 1981, and a leading measure of consumer sentiment, had its biggest one-month decline ever. And what started with housing is now spreading rapidly to the consumer, loan sectors, credit card defaults, as alluded to by Jamie Dimon, are soaring along with delinquent auto loans. Jessica Silver Greenberg had this passage in a piece for Business Week. Making matters worse for the big banks, the subprime threat is also greater in credit card land. Risky borrowers with low credit scores account for roughly 30% of outstanding credit card debt, compared with 11% of mortgage debt. More than 45% of Washington Mutual's credit card portfolio is subprime, according to Innovest. That could become a headache for JPMorgan Chase, which agreed on September 25th to buy the troubled thrift's credit card business and other assets for $1.9 billion. So read Business Week. Noted bear Jeremy Grantham had some of the following thoughts in an interview with Barron's October 13th. Question, what is your sense of how this crisis has been handled by those in charge? Grantham, it's been a haphazard response, and next time something happens, you can't be sure what will happen. In one deal, they protect the bonds, while in the next deal, the bonds go. Then in the next deal, they protect the foreign bonds, but not the domestic bonds. My guess is that people will be nervous that they will be at the bad end of one of the tough deals rather than one of the more gentle ones. Question, what was at the core of what got the financial system into this crisis? Grantham, it was the belief by a lot of people who counted that financial bubbles did not have to be addressed. The thinking was that you could step in and, by scattering a bit of money around, ease the downside consequences. Therefore, you could let the tech bubble run amok and wait for it to burst and step in. And you could let the housing bubble run amok and step in. At the center of this crisis was a bubble and risk-taking. The risk premiums dropped off the cosmic scale, the lowest ever recorded. Question. Do you think we will learn anything from all of this turmoil? Grantham. We will learn an enormous amount in a very short time, quite a bit in the medium term, and absolutely nothing in the long term. That would be the historical precedent. Question, where do you see all this going? Grantham, I want to emphasize how little I understand all of the intricate workings of the global financial system. I hope that someone else gets it, because I don't, and I have no idea really how this will work out. I certainly wish it hadn't happened. It's just so intricate that all I can conclude by instinct and by reading the history books is that it will be longer, harder, and more complicated than we expect. But there is some good news, I suppose. Professor Burton Malkiel of the Random Walk on Wall Street wrote in a op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, just because stock markets have panicked, investors should not. The best position for investors today is not fetal and 100% in cash. We are not going to have a depression, and we have survived financial crises before. A century of investing experience, as well as insights from the field of behavioral finance, suggest that investors who bail out of equities during times like these are almost always making the wrong decision. Malkiel adds, we will have a serious recession now, but a 1930s-style depression is highly unlikely. No one has consistently made money by selling America short, and I'm confident the same lesson is true today. Of course, you all heard about Warren Buffett and his op-ed for the New York Times. Buffett wrote, the financial world is a mess both in the United States and abroad. Its problems, moreover, have been leaking into the general economy, and the leaks are now turning into a gusher. In the near term, unemployment will rise, business activity will falter, and headlines will continue to be scary. So, Buffett writes, I've been buying American stocks. This is my personal account I'm talking about, in which I previously owned nothing but United States government bonds. If prices keep looking attractive, my non-Berkshire Hathaway net worth will soon be 100% in United States equities. Why? A simple rule dictates my buying. Be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy when others are fearful. And most certainly, fear is now widespread, gripping even seasoned investors. To be sure, investors are right to be wary of highly leveraged entities or businesses in weak competitive positions, but fears regarding the long-term prosperity of the nation's many sound companies make no sense. These businesses will indeed suffer earnings hiccups, as they always have, but most major companies will be setting new profit records 5, 10, and 20 years from now. Buffett concludes, Over the long term, the stock market news will be good. In the 20th century, the United States endured two world wars and other traumatic and expensive military conflicts. The Depression, a dozen or so recessions and financial panics, oil shocks, a flu epidemic, and the resignation of a disgraced president. Yet the Dow rose from 66 to 11,497. Today, people hold cash equivalents, feel comfortable. They shouldn't. They've opted for a terrible long-term asset, one that pays virtually nothing and is certain to depreciate in value. Indeed, the policies the government will follow in its efforts to alleviate the current crisis will probably prove inflationary and therefore accelerate declines in the real value of cash accounts. So spoke Warren Buffett. Well, how about this outrageous week we had on Wall Street? Monday saw the biggest point gain by far ever for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, up 936, or 11%. The latter the biggest percentage gain since 1933. But Wednesday then witnessed a second 700-point decline in 2 weeks. This one's 733. Then the Dow rose 401 on Thursday, and when it all shook out, stocks had staged their best advance since 2003, with the Dow up 4.8% to 8852, the S&P up 4.6%, and NASDAQ ahead 3.8%. There were actually a few smiles on the street by week's end. Earnings for the third quarter began to flood in, and they were mixed in terms of actual numbers and our forecast. Coca-Cola was good, PepsiCo poor, Johnson & Johnson good, eBay awful, Citigroup poor, IBM so-so, Schlumberger poor, Google good. All over the board, in other words. Future profits over the coming weeks will reveal the same, as the July-September period is ancient history and flat-out irrelevant, while the outlook for coming quarters is foggy at best. I do want to mention some good news. Crude oil, which was trading below $70 before finishing the week at $72, is now at its lowest weekly close since August of 07. It's the ongoing story of demand destruction fueled by an unwinding of the hedge fund's positions. And to think that just 3 months ago we peaked at 147, days after I wrote on July 5th that, quote, there is no way you can validate $145 oil, close quote, as I went on to compare the bubble in crude to that of the tech sector. I have to also note that the week before I nailed the peak in corn to the day, 1770, now 403. The destruction in the energy sector has been unreal. Valero, for example, has a 52-week high of $72, but closed the week at $18 after hitting $17. National oil well Varco, a big-time high flyer, hit $92 over the past year, but traded at $20 this week before finishing Friday at $25. But if you're not an investor in the sector, you should be fired up to get a break at the gas pump. With gasoline futures at $1.70, an average nationwide pump price, barring a snapback higher, of $2.30 to $2.40 is just a few weeks away. And that's your week in review for October 13th, October 17th. Be sure to check out the full column, a rather extensive one, at stocksandnews.com. This is Brian Trumbull. I won't be coming to you for a while because I'm going to be doing some extensive travel, both in the American West and later China. But check the site for future postings. Thank you.